Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on a contract worker that has died as a result of an accident at the BP Whiting Refinery. Parents of Gary Community School Corp students voiced their frustrations at the State Board of Education meeting. Sharon Jackson speaks with Michelle Murday of EnviroForensics about an honor she recently received. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with community activist Ruth Needleman. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Two schools in Chesterton are closed after traces of Legionella bacteria were discovered at the schools. The Doolin School Corporation said an employee self-reported a positive test of Legionnaire's disease. It is not known where the employee contracted the disease, but preliminary results revealed that traces of Legionella bacteria were found in the water system at Chesterton Middle School and in the cooling tower of Westchester Intermediate School. Both schools are closed and will conduct an e-learning day. The Doolin School Corporation Administration Center is also closed. The Porter County Health Department has been notified, and further tests on the water and air systems are being conducted. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A 23-year-old tradesman died on the job Wednesday at the BP Whiting Refinery. BP spokesperson Michael Abendoff confirmed to The Times that a contract worker was injured Wednesday at the Whiting Refinery. BP's local medical staff provided immediate assistance, but Gilberto Rangel Jr. of Griffith was later pronounced dead by the Lake County Coroner's Office just before 11 a.m. The cause of death was blunt force trauma. The Whiting Fire Department says Rangel fell about 30 feet. Rangel was reportedly a first-year apprentice with Pipefitters Local 597, which is a Chicago-based union with union halls in Mokena and Crown Point. BP is a highly automated refinery. It employs about 1,800 workers.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Parents and others angrily called out the State Board of Education at its meeting Wednesday in Gary. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports, they say the state's intervention in local schools is failing.
In 2012, the state took over Roosevelt High School for academic failure. In 2017, the entire Gary Community School District was taken over due to massive debt. The goal is to turn around both so they can be sustainable. But parent LaRonna Carter says students have been let down by state officials and the companies hired to manage the schools.
When a takeover happens, that means I'm going to do a better job than what you were doing when you had it. We are not seeing that. And now we're going into 3 years.
It was reported Wednesday that one school's roof is leaking in 10 places. At Roosevelt, students are being taught in a garage off campus because the school was unsafe for classes. The board called for its staff to propose 3 remedies for Roosevelt at next month's meeting. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's State Board of Education on Wednesday passed a major change to how it grades, and then at the very same meeting voted to reverse its own decision. Chalkbeat Indiana reports that the State Board approved a cap on what are called growth scores, which measure year-over-year school performance, but then rejected the motion. Each year, Indiana gives each school an A through F grade meant to evenly weigh student growth and passing rates on state tests. But a board member, David Freitas, said the grading system skews unfairly toward growth.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The fetal remains found in a late abortion provider's Illinois garage have been moved to St. Joseph County, Indiana.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingard reports.
After Dr. Ulrich Klopfer died in early September, more than 2,200 medically preserved fetal remains were found stored in his garage. Klopfer performed abortions in South Bend, Gary, and Fort Wayne until his license was suspended in 2016. The remains were transferred to the St. Joseph County, Indiana coroner on Wednesday. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill is heading the investigation.
Will it produce the answers that everybody wants? Probably not. Will it produce the closure that everybody needs? Probably not. But it will produce a transparent process moving forward on what we can do to correct a bad situation and provide as much human dignity as we possibly can under the circumstances.
Hill says documentation found shows the remains were from abortions performed between 2000 and 2002. He says the remains were moved to St. Joseph County not because they know they came from here originally, but because the county coroner was the first to step forward with the capacity for the investigation. I'm Jennifer Weingart in South Bend.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The president of the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations visited striking auto workers from a central Indiana General Motors facility Tuesday afternoon. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports the stop comes as contract negotiations continue.
United Auto Workers officials released a statement Tuesday saying a contract proposal from GM failed to meet union members' demands or needs. While union leaders say they're waiting a response to their counterproposal, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka spoke with UAW workers in Bedford. The AFL-CIO consists of 55 unions, including the United Auto Workers. UAW Local 440 President Kevin Hutchinson says Trumka's visit with workers from the GM Bedford casting facility was an honor.
His message was to them that the members of the AFL-CIO, they have our backs, they're supporting us, and his message to them was one day longer, one day stronger.
The UAW strike against GM is now in its third week and affects thousands of Hoosier workers throughout the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Online sports betting is now legally available in the Hoosier State. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports two providers began offering mobile wagers Thursday.
Lawmakers legalized sports wagering, including online bets, earlier this year. The ban on such bets lifted September 1st, and most of the state's casinos began offering in-person sports gambling last month. But the online portion wasn't ready to go as gaming operators set up their systems. Now, two casinos in East Chicago and French Lick are offering mobile bets via DraftKings and Rush Street, two of the biggest names in mobile sports betting. Online sports wagering is geofenced in Indiana, meaning people must be within state lines to place their bets. Experts expect the bulk of sports wagering revenues will occur via the online platforms. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A state summer study committee recommends that Indiana find the money for a federal study into beach erosion along Lake Michigan. High water levels on the lake and man-made structures like seawalls have caused erosion along several beaches in northwest Indiana, including those at Indiana National Dunes Park. Lakeshore towns and environmentalists are concerned this will affect tourism along the lake and harm vulnerable plants and animal species. The committee suggests the state come up with about $850,000 to go toward a study by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to develop long-term solutions to Lake Michigan beach erosion. There's no telling whether the governor and the state budget committee will act upon that recommendation. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Northwest Indiana woman is making a name for herself in the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM field, and has been named Up-and-Coming Woman of the Year in STEM. The honoree, Michelle Murday, Northwest Indiana Branch Manager for Enviroforensics, was chosen by the Northwest Indiana Influential Women's Association. She talks with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about her career and plans to help young women get into STEM fields.
So I'm originally from Northwest Indiana, graduated from Munster, and then from Munster went to Ball State, and then lived in Indianapolis 5 years before I moved back up here last year.
Okay, well, congratulations. I understand that there's an inaugural award in STEM, and you have been named up-and-coming Woman of the Year in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math.
Yes.
Congratulations. How did you do that?
Thank you. So it all started was I was nominated. I'm not 100% sure by who. And then from there, you go through an application process. It's pretty lengthy, pretty extensive. Letters of recommendation, any awards, publications, your resume. You know, they ask you some questions about how you chose your field, challenges and obstacles you might have had along the way.
So how did you choose your field and how did you get into STEM?
Okay, so it's a pretty funny story. When I was in high school, probably just like everyone else, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I actually applied to Ball State with entrepreneurship because I thought I wanted to own my own restaurant after working at the Shoops in Munster throughout high school. And then when it got to, I think it was my senior year, second semester, I took an earth space science class. And when we got to the rock and mineral sections, it just completely piqued my interest. It's nothing I had ever thought about. So from there, I started thinking, you know, is this something I could do? What's there to even do with rocks? You know, most people are like, how is rocks a career? So then from there, I actually purchased a book called Great Jobs for Geology Majors. And after reading the first couple of chapters in that, I had switched my career path at Ball State from entrepreneurship to geology.
Is your job, does it have to do with geology now?
It did when I first started. So when I first started at Enviroforensics, I was a field geologist, and that required me to go out and collect a lot of soil, water, and vapor samples. And in collecting those samples, you also have to describe any lithology you see, so the different types of soils that you can collect.
How did you kind of move up through the ranks in your job? But tell me a little bit about your career then.
Okay, so when I was a field geologist, we obviously did, I was more out in the field performing the oversight of all the investigation activities. And, you know, a lot of that's to determine the historical spills on the site. So we collect those samples and they go to a lab. And then from the lab, we can tell where the spill might have, general area of where the spill might have been released and to what extent and if we need to investigate any further or not. And then while I was also a field geologist, I performed the oversight of the remedial activities. So once we got full site investigation, then we could go through and figure out how are we going to clean up the issue. And then from there, I started writing some of the, like, our smaller reports, began analyzing the data. And about a year and a half into my career, I was promoted to a staff geologist. And that's where I started to write some of the larger investigation and remediation reports, and then interpreting the analytical data. And then to help with that, it would be to develop our conceptual site models. And then as part of that, Enviroforensics gave me the opportunity to go to Golden, Colorado to learn a software called RockWorks. And that actually allows us to prepare three-dimensional visualizations of the contamination. So we can actually put everything into this software, and it'll give us, you know, the plume shape, size, you can put in lithology, the groundwater elevation. So it's kind of really cool to see, maybe a little hard to describe over the phone of what exactly it looks like. And then from there, I was promoted to project manager. And then at that time, kind of more of what it sounds, I began managing each of the projects by implementing and advancing the investigation and remediation activities, just to make sure, you know, everything's done within the work scopes, preparing the work scopes, making sure everything's to quality control standards. And then we also have to manage all the administrative, budgetary, and technical aspects of all of our assigned projects.
For women, you know, who are in high school now and they want to get into STEM, what's your advice to them?
So STEM, trades, arts, or any other career, just follow your gut and do something that you're passionate about. If anyone says you can't do it or shouldn't do what you want to do, just use that to fuel your fire. Every time somebody told me I couldn't do it or I wasn't going to make it in my career path, I wanted to prove them wrong that much more and show them that I could do it and I was meant to do something that I wanted to do. And then some days will be hard and challenging, but those days you know that you're learning. And if you aren't sure of an answer or how to do something, never be afraid to ask questions and treat every day as a learning experience and never stop growing.
Did people actually tell you along the way that you wouldn't make it?
Multiple. Probably the end of my junior year, I was the president for the Ball State Geological Society. And one of the people at the job fair, another lady, actually came up to me and told me that I was never going to make it because I was there in high heels. And everyone in the environmental field is always in some kind of steel-toed boots. And to this day, I find it funny because I wear high heels daily, but I do have my steel-toed boots in my car at all times.
Very good.
Right?
Very good. Congratulations to you on all that.
Thank you.
What are your future plans, and how are you going to, I mean, being in the position that you are, how are you going to give back to the community?
I would really like to start mentoring maybe a couple of women in the area or even a group of women that maybe are interested in a career path in STEM, just, you know, to help them maybe get through some of the struggles that they might have along the way, or insecurities, or just, you know, questions. Because some of my classes, I know I was the only female in an all-male class, and sometimes that in itself could be intimidating. So just give them the encouragement that you can get through it.
You know, I don't want to be negative, but why is it so hard for women to get into STEM? I mean, is it, and it seems like more guys get into it. Is it just like the way our brains are wired?
That's a question that I wish I knew the answer to. I don't know if it's just a more of a gender role type thing of, you know, you grow up and all your friends are going into X, Y, or Z, and why do you have to fall in one of those categories? Why can't you go into a STEM field?
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Ruth Needleman.
In Northwest Indiana, political activist Ruth Needleman is back with us to talk about a number of things, including some recent events that you probably already know about if you read the story in the Times of an organization that's come out with a listing of cities and how one Northwest Indiana city did not fare very well. In fact, they were at the dead last on the list.
Well, no, I think there were about 10 last place winners.
Oh, really? There were that many?
Yeah,
okay,
there were the most miserable cities. But Gary is miserable in many ways. I've lived here a long time, but I love my city. And what is really miserable about Gary is the corrupt politicians. I mean, the head of the school board walks away with thousands of dollars theft, and the head of the common council shoots teenagers who have stolen a car on a joyride. I mean, this kind of stuff, that's miserable. The fact that the lawyer for the city council has teamed up with a crook to buy up properties that he knew from insider information would be valuable, that's miserable. But what's not miserable about Gary are, of course, the people who live here.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who live here have made this an exceptional city. This was the home of the first National Black Political Caucus. It was the center of the struggle to build the steel industry. And it was this community that shut down GEO, a private prison, not once, but twice. And also, this is where NWI Resist, my organization, has been fighting the deportations, has been supporting Rashad Cunningham's demand, his family's demand for justice. We are a community that has suffered. But the misery is the politicians and the corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it is right to call us a miserable city. I say the people who made this point are miserable people.
I noticed that in the article that we're referring to, the story that came out about Gary being a miserable city was one of Times business reporter Joe Pete's articles, and he talked with some people about that, and he was talking with one businessman in Gary, and he says that the problems are not as much the crime and the poverty, I guess, to a point, but certainly the the way that the community has fallen apart over the years. But he says about the fact that there just aren't many opportunities, or the opportunities are not there for businesses to be able to either have the complete efforts to set forth into the city or to be able to grow in the city.
Well, I think the first item on my agenda to report on mm-hmm. is a response to that.
Right.
Because certainly there has been development in the city. We had the baseball stadium. We had a new building for Indiana University. There has been all kind of construction at the airport. The problem has been that all this development has not brought a single benefit to the city of Gary as a whole, to the community of Gary. It has, in fact, done all this work without hiring people who live in Gary. And so all the money just bleeds right out of the city and does not help to establish a strong base for the city. So there's been a group of people, quite an impressive group of people, including state representatives, a city council member, attorneys, people from the Indiana Plan, who have been working hard on what's called a community benefit agreement. And a community benefit agreement is something that says you're going to build a casino, you're going to spend millions of dollars. What is the community going to get in exchange? And how many people who live in Gary will get jobs so that the money that you invest actually stays, a little bit of it, in Gary? And so this committee has been meeting with the mayor. It has met with the people from the casino developers. And what it's saying is, first of all, let's see some real investment in the community. How about a park? How about some programs for youth? And then in local hiring, how about money to train people in Gary with a promise that they will be employed? Because as long as no one in Gary gets a job, the money leaves Gary. And so a community benefits agreement, which has been practiced in the Midwest, it started out in California, but really all over the country, is an agreement that the people who live in a city will benefit from development instead of developers getting filthy rich and the city getting very little, because the casino revenue will go to the casino. We're probably going to build roads and give them all kinds of benefits. What do we get? And there's meetings today. There have been meetings for the last 4 weeks. And we're very hopeful that we will get one. We were promised something. We were promised money for training. We were promised money for oversight. Because what often happens is they say, okay, there'll be local hiring as practicable or as possible, and then they hire no one. So we want oversight to make sure that promises become realities. And there will be a whole series of forums coming up to educate the community about what a community benefits agreement would mean. Mm-hmm. And it certainly would cut out a bunch of misery in Gary, because the people are not responsible for the unemployment. The people are not responsible for the fact that the city is bankrupt. I mean, most of us pay our taxes, but a lot of us don't earn enough to pay anything. And that's because they don't get jobs. It's because there's a lot of runaways. So put that on your calendar to keep your eye open for a public meeting on community benefits agreements.
Okay.
The other self-serving announcement, the Gary Crusader, which is our black newspaper in Gary, started publishing a four-part series that I wrote on the 1919 steel strike. This is the 100th anniversary of that strike. And to this day, people say, oh, that strike, it pitted whites against blacks. Well, the real story, and you can read it in the Gary Crusader, is that in fact in Gary, there was unbelievable racial solidarity. And it was because they did everything right. There were two black leaders on the council. They spoke at every rally. They had separate meetings a year in advance for Hungarians, Polish, Mexican, and colored iron and steel workers. They educated, they united, and the only reason the strike was broke in Gary is because an incident that was nothing was later heralded as racial hostilities. There was not a single black person, by the way, involved. And they called in the National Guard and the federal troops, and they shut the strike down. But anyhow, you'll want to read this. It's a great story.
One thing, too, you've brought this up before, and we've had time to talk about it in more detail, but let's at least mention, well, with little time we have left today, is about kind of an update on the Can We Talk series of conversations.
Absolutely. This is so promising. We have moved the location for this. This is a community-based healing program. And by healing, what it means is by building community and sharing our stories and feeling the support and empathy of our neighbors, we can overcome the isolation and the anxiety and even some of the depression of trauma-related events. And it takes place now at Community Health Net, the fourth Monday of every month. Mm-hmm. And it begins with a free meal. Hear that? A wonderful hot dinner. Vegetables, potatoes, chicken, desserts. And we also provide free daycare. So you can come with your kids and we will have fun with them while you share stories with your community. We have a jazz musician who plays through dinner. We have other entertainment. Our resident poet is Tara Cooks, who, by the way, has been nominated to be the Poet Laureate of Indiana.
Wow.
Yes, because I was one of the nominators. Okay. But she, her poetry is so empowering because it's so much out of the life of people who live in Gary. And we also have musicians, therapists who do musical stuff while we get to help with maybe we shake things or we play drums. But it's really a wonderful, warm, and supportive meeting. The next one is October, 28th.
Yes.
And it will start at 6 o'clock. And Community Health Net, the main place right there on Broadway, and it's kind of Fifth Avenue and Buchanan. And I really invite you to come and bring your friends. You will be so happy you did.
Well, Ruth, thank you for spending time with us to talk about these topics and all. And we know we're keeping an eye on the immigration situation, and as you are, too, not only around here, but what happens next door over in Chicago.
And also what's happening nationally.
That's right.
I really have to say that, do you know, I got a phone call this morning from a friend in Florence, Italy. She said, so what do you think about those alligators and poisonous snakes? I said, what? She said, top news story on the Italian television was that Trump's new suggestion for protecting the border is to have alligators and poisonous snakes mm-hmm. put along the wall.
That was, that's supposedly outlined, having been said in the White House, is outlined in a new book that's coming out from some people that worked in the administration that they've overheard.
I don't even know what to say. Give me a break. This is just the mind of a madman, an awful, a very hateful, hating person who doesn't understand that the greatness of this country has come from indigenous and immigrant labor.
Well, Ruth, thank you for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.